What's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm your host, King Kaz. I'm joined by my co-host, the great JBZ.
It's good to be back. Let's do this.
Good to be back. Before we hop in the roundup, did you check out the UFC fight last night?
I did, because I always check out Nate Diaz fights.
Which is the thing I wanted to talk about. It was a relatively, not a long fight, but not necessarily a quick fight. But I thought it was pretty good. I haven't seen Nate Diaz fight in a while, so
that's why. Since he lost a very close decision to Conor McGregor a couple of years ago, which was a rematch after he unexpectedly beat Conor McGregor the time before that. So yeah, it's been a few years. For some reason, there's just always something that's just intrigued me about Nate Diaz, just because he comes from Stockton, California, which is very close to where I grew up. So it's there's kind of a part of like a hometown thing for him, except he's also kind of he embodies the kind of personality that I hate about that area. but like, he's just so unabashedly that kind of person that that I can't help but appreciate him for that. And he's always repping the 209, and so it's just like, there, I don't know if I've ever seen a person that more embodies that type of personality more than Nate Diaz does. And just the way he fights, it's like he's just this weird, squirrely kind of like, he doesn't look like he's super ripped like a lot of other fighters do. He just
very long arms, long limbs.
Yeah, long arms, long limbs. He's kind of awkward looking, awkward fighting, but like, he's just so skilled at so many different things that it's like you're fighting flubber, kind of, except he's not fat. He's just kind of like, but like that type of, like that level of difficulty, just fighting a guy that doesn't seem to be able to take any punishment and, or that doesn't seem to visibly react to any punishment that you give him, and just somehow, it doesn't matter like what kind of submission hold you get him into, he somehow squirrels his way into a different hold, and it's just like he's fun to watch in that sort of way. So I did tune in.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to get around to, is like you kind of embodied the whole thing. Nate Diaz is this very odd guy that you don't think should be there, but he's fun to watch, even though he seems of a type that would be certainly annoying.
He's a raging douchebag, or at least he seems like it.
Probably playing it up a bit. I think he does play it up a bit.
Yeah, probably. Or not. I don't know. You can't tell. So that's when it's the best, is when you can't tell.
All right, let's hit the roundup. We're going to start with a little bit of League of Legends news. Now, we've been following the story of Echo Fox and kind of all of their woes as it goes, having one of their board members get involved with a racial incident with their owner, Rick Fox, which led to Rick Fox initially leaving his position at Echo Fox, then deciding to come back to try to oust that said board member. Riot at a certain point kind of put a timeline on that, and I think we are now at the tail end of that timeline.
I think we are past it. They were basically given 60 days, and then last month Echo Fox, I think they reached the point where like they couldn't sort this out within 60 days, so they reached a deal with Kroenke Sports and Entertainment to sell their League of Legends Championship Series, which is the North American League, to sell their franchise spot to Kroenke, which I believe they own the LA Rams and the Denver Nuggets, that whole family. That sale didn't go through. And this is not the they're not selling the Echo Fox organization. They're just selling the franchise spot for their LCS team.
Yeah, which would mean within these year or so, Echo Fox would not be allowed to, or not be competing in LCS.
Correct. And so that's still going to be the case, even though that deal fell through. that a League of Legends, or I guess the LCS, is now agreeing to sell that spot, and because Echo Fox couldn't figure out how to sell it themselves, so the league is now going to sell it, and they'll give the proceeds, whatever they can get for the spot, to Echo Fox. But basically, Echo Fox wasn't able to reach a deal on their own, but they can't delay this any further. The league is going to step in, and they're going to handle this from now on. And that's how serious the league is about making a stand. Like we said at the time, like it's hard to oust one of your own investors, and it's difficult. So when you can't do that, then ultimately the league has to step in. Threatening from the league was not enough to push Echo Fox into, it was enough to push them into selling, but it wasn't enough to get a deal done. So now the league has to handle it themselves. They'll probably just have to auction it. And it's kind of a sad ending to a sad situation. I guess it's not even over yet. We'll have to wait and see. This is step 9 of 10, I guess.
Yeah, but like we said, Echo Fox will continue as an organization. So maybe within that, they can find some kind of way to rectify their situation by getting this investor off of their board and out of their hair, so to speak, and then maybe that will allow them to then pursue getting back into League of Legends. We've talked about before, especially with DJM, who's our producer, about them being in other like esports things, like fighting games and things of that nature.
Yeah, and I guess if those organizations decide that they want to take a stand too, then they probably can. I know we've talked about fighting games being a little bit less centralized, so maybe it won't have such a big impact if one tournament decides not to allow them to come in because of this one owner. It's a messy situation. It's a tough situation for them to be in, but that's kind of why you have to vet your ownership group. And it's kind of a reminder that we focus a lot on the players and the things that they do, sometimes shitty things, and ownership is just as capable of doing awful things like players are. So for the LCS, this is actually going to be, I believe, the third team that is going to not just change ownership, but like rebrand. They have 10 teams in the LCS. They franchised a couple of years ago to lock those 10 teams in. I think they've had that same lineup for about 2 years now. But going into next season, 3 of the teams are going to be different. So it's almost like we're kind of going back to the age of when they were promoting and relegating teams.
Which I would love them to do. I would love to go back to that system. But like this weird one we're in where like everybody's trying to copy. Well, not everybody. Overwatch and Riot are more so trying to copy an NFL style league system rather than a soccer league system like they've kind of had. And I would really love for them to go back kind of to the soccer system.
Yeah. They have financial reasons for doing it this way, and which I understand, but personally,
I do understand from a security standpoint for players, it does allow them the ability to just kind of have a more stable paycheck and things like that. But then it feels like when a player is like kind of out like when a team decides, okay, like, you know, we don't want to have this player on our team anymore, especially across esports. There's very little avenues for them other than like trying to get into streaming. But if they already weren't the biggest streamer to begin with, you know, like in their scheduling, then this is adding a new flavor to them for them to try to make money, you know? And it's like, you have these journeymen in esports that like now are locked in to so much more limited pools than before. So it's just, I don't know. It's weird. It
definitely is a more collusive environment than the old ways of everybody just being an independent team. I guess that's what they want. So,
mm-hmm. And I mean, I feel like in a weird sense, and then we can move on from here. Like, I feel like in a weird sense, you lose, you lose a little bit of that flavor that made League popular. Like you lose the whole like story of things like TSM, which was this, like you said, homegrown team that came up and dominated and things like that, because now it seems so much more professional. So it doesn't have that, I don't know. It just doesn't have that thing that it had. And I don't know if that's good or bad yet.
Yep. Moving on to baseball news. The Little League World Series is going on right now. It's kind of one of my favorite fun little events in August, which is usually devoid of a lot of sports stuff. So, yeah. If you got ESPN and the ESPN networks, you can catch kids playing baseball, and it's I've always found it kind of fun, just because these are 6-inning games. They're short. The kids are always having fun until the end when they cry. That's always tough to watch, but until then, they're having a lot of fun, and sometimes you see kids, you know, going nuts over their teammates, hitting home runs. It feels a lot less, it feels a lot more pure watching kids play baseball than watching adults play baseball. I don't want to sound like a purist, but it's just kids having fun, and instead of, I mean,
it has that thing where they're trying to win, right? It's not like they're not trying to win, but they're having fun, right? Because they all come out to Florida and get to meet all these other kids who have the same passion that they do, and experience and play the game, you know, like at for them what seems like a very professional level, right? Because
yeah,
there's also, all the cameras, there's all the press and all that other stuff.
It is also a legitimate World Series. The world is competing there,
yes,
too.
This is
so
true.
It's like the, you know, there are teams from other nations, and then the final is the best U.S. team versus the best world team, and mm-hmm. and so it's, you know, not only are these, you know, these kids are there, they're, you know, or these American kids are there, and they're meeting each other, and then they're also meeting kids from around the world too. Like I've seen pictures in the past of them, like, you know, there are these two kids from two completely different countries that don't speak the same language, but they're out there, you know, using Google Translate on their phone to try to talk to each other, and you know, it gives you hope for both the sport of baseball and for the society at large. These kids are the future, and they're
well, yeah, you say that, but then they're going to get to high school, and it's going to be
fun. All right, but that's the parents' fault. I still blame the parents for most of that.
What else is going on? Baseball. There's some other stuff going up in baseball. Yeah.
I guess we missed the trade deadline talk a couple weeks ago. The Houston Astros loaded up. Bryce Harper is heating up. Right now, he's kind of had, you know, for all the hoopla of his free agency in the offseason. And then he signed a massive contract, which then Mike Trout trumped with an even bigger contract. You know, Harper, he's kind of had a quiet season for somebody as good as he is. He's had a good season, but, you know, you could argue that it's not like a kind of season you would expect from a from a guy who just signed a $330 million contract. But recently he's been in the news for hitting some pretty clutch home runs. I think in a lot of these situations, like somebody's heckling him for the contract that he signed and saying that like he's overrated, he's a waste. Like these are like clips from the crowd. And then like right after that, he just hits a home run. The most recent one was a walk-off grand slam that he hit. And that was nuts. That, you know, it won the game. I don't think I've ever seen anybody who didn't need to run the bases that fast run the bases that fast. he ran that like somebody was chasing him, and he totally didn't need to. So he's getting fired up. He's heating up. The Philadelphia Phillies are one game behind the last wild card spot, and they've got about 39 games left. So yeah. Things are heating up. We're getting close to October.
Well, right now the Phillies are eight games behind.
Maybe behind in their division, but as far as the wild card goes, there are five wild card teams now in each conference. Mm-hmm. Five playoff teams now in each conference. So things are opening up a little bit, and we're starting to see, you know, which teams are rising to the top and which teams are just duds.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to bring up before we move on from this Bryce Harper thing is, why is it in baseball we expect a guy who signs a max contract to be just amazing, but in other sports, well, primarily basketball, and I think this is the added of LeBron, is like you more expect those big money guys to start to heat up when playoff time comes around rather than during the regular season?
I think in basketball, more than half the teams make the playoffs, and in baseball, only a third of the league makes the playoffs. Also in basketball, there's kind of like one player, there's five people on the court at a time. So like one player makes a really big difference. So I think that results in, and also just the fact that there is a max contract in basketball. Baseball doesn't have a max contract. They don't have a minimum either, I don't think. Or at least not like a salary floor for the entire team. So like people don't get paid as much in general, in basketball, there is that cap there of a, this is the most that one player who's played this many years in the league can make. Guys like LeBron are underpaid because if the league wasn't capped, they would get paid a lot more. But mediocre players end up getting paid more because they end up getting max contracts. So, okay.
I mean, yeah, I could,
like in baseball, I feel like there's no middle ground. There's market value and all that, but if like in baseball, like you basically get paid pennies, and you know, when you're a young player, and then the team will exploit you as much as they can. They'll manipulate your service time so they can get more out of you while you're on that tiny contract that you have when you start. Well, once you hit free agency, that's when you get your big payday, and only a few people make it that far. But when they do, they get massive contracts. The value of a Bryce Harper versus the value of the rest of his team is a pretty big chunk, and there's just a massive gap in that level. There really isn't that middle level anymore, I don't think. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it did. I
just took that and ran with that.
But I think it was a definite answer to that question. I'm excited to see Bryce Harper heat up. I mean, I'm also excited because the Yankees are doing relatively well. But we will have more to talk about the Yankees later. For now, we're going to talk about Antonio Brown. I think we brought this up last week.
Yep.
That Antonio Brown was having some helmet troubles. Jones, and was looking to have a discussion with the league about it.
Yeah, there were reports that he was threatening to retire. His grievance with the league was denied. So he's basically at the point where he has to either buck it up and use one of the helmets that he has available to him from the team, or he can go out and find his old helmet if we can find one that has been made within the last 10 years that can pass the NFL's tests, or not the NFL, but the organization that does the testing. I think he's found a couple that don't pass the tests. But yeah, he's been reaching out over social media, like trying to get anybody who has one of those helmets to hit him up. Anybody that has one of those helmets that's been made within the last 10 years. And I mean, the helmet's been discontinued in 2011. So
if he
manages to find one this year, he's going to have to make the switch eventually. So it's a lot of effort for, I guess for something that makes him comfortable.
But, so I'm weirdly surprised that some kind of helmet manufacturing company hasn't like hit him up just to be like, hey, let's see if we can make a helmet that one passes the test and two does the things you want it to do. You know what I mean? Like, and go from there, right? Like based on the design that he wants, but holds up to current NFL, you know, standards. And like, why is no one hit this guy up? Because one, that's just great publicity to do that. I think, I think that gives you a good amount of clout for, I think, a story that a lot of people are somewhat looking at. And I just don't understand why that hasn't happened.
Probably because they feel like if they don't do anything, this will go away. Like at some point, Antonio Brown has to make money. He has to play in order to make money. So, DJM asks, why isn't Antonio Brown actually just reaching out to one of these companies and paying them to make a helmet for him?
Yeah, I guess that could go both ways.
Yeah, they could do that too. They don't manufacture these things en masse anymore. So doing like a one-off would be, you know, maybe cost prohibitive from a manufacturing perspective. But like you said, it's advertisement at this point. But then again, like if this is all for one person, then maybe that one person should be paying for this.
Yeah. No, I think the way DJM presents it is the way it should probably go. But I don't know. I feel like you go for the clout reach as a helmet manufacturer, and you're like, hey, we'll make the helmet that passes the test that fits you the way you want it to fit. And then like you just blast that all over Instagram and Twitter and YouTube. Like you make a whole YouTube documentary about you building the helmet for Antonio Brown. Like, go
for it. I mean, I plan on making the point later that sometimes the financially efficient thing is not the best way to go. Sometimes it makes sense to sink in a little bit of money here and there. So maybe that'll happen. I don't know how that would work with league regulations, but assuming that it passes all the right tests, then, you know, right now there are 34 other helmet designs out there to choose from. Maybe this will be just a 35th one, specifically sanctioned and paid for by Antonio Brown. But I mean, he's also not the only player that, you know, gets super anal about their helmets. He's just the kind of the most recent one. But
yeah,
you know, guys like Tom Brady are really superstitious about their helmets, so that they want to keep using their old ones. But they've quietly moved on and transitioned. They've accepted the rules instead of trying to fight them like Antonio Brown has.
I guess.
But who knows? Maybe he's a pioneer.
Let's move on to a little bit of unfortunate news in basketball. One of our favorite people to follow here at Sports Odds and Ends is DeMarcus Cousins. And unfortunately, news came out that he tore his ACL and will be out indefinitely.
Yeah. So we've talked about the Lakers loading up, the Clippers loading up, the Battle of LA. DeMarcus Cousins was, he was kind of an afterthought when he signed. But, you know, this is one of the five all-stars in the famed Warriors all-star lineup. And, you know, he kind of defiantly signed with the Warriors last year. Everybody knew that they were getting an amazing deal signing him for the mid-level exception. And, this year he got injured again, but was back in time for the playoffs. And then, got injured again in the playoffs, kind of played through it. Now it's the off season. I think he was playing in some little scrimmage or something. He was just playing a game during a workout, basically. And he bumped knees with somebody, tore his ACL. So now the Lakers are looking for a center. There are the only one they have on the roster right now is JaVale McGee. They are considering all options, including Dwight Howard right now, who is under contract with the Memphis Grizzlies. And nobody expects him to actually play for the Grizzlies, but he hasn't actually been released yet. So maybe they might have to work out some sort of trade or something. DJM asked me during the week, you know, could the Lakers actually void that contract that he signed, that DeMarcus Cousins signed? This was just a basketball injury. Like if he was out riding his motorcycle or something, which is prohibited in NFL contracts and actually pretty much all sports contracts now, or if he was doing something dangerous or did something really stupid, they could void the contract. Or if he was doing anything prohibited by the contract and then got injured as a result, they could void the contract. But even then, he only signed for $3.5 million. So it's not like they would get a lot of cap room from that. And they would probably take a PR hit from doing that as well. Just like when somebody gets injured and then you just completely cut ties with them, it really looks like you're kicking them while they're down. And it sends whatever you do to the people you currently have under contract sends a message to people that might consider signing with you in the future. So if it's like, sure, you might have the technical legal cause to do something like that, but doing that might give you a bigger PR hit than whatever you might say by making this kind of move.
Yeah. The bad karma is not worth the money save.
Okay. Well, I mean, injuries like this kind of, it's, you know, we're getting towards the end of the off season, I would say. The season's going to start in mid October. So preseason's going to start kind of soon. Right now there's the FIBA World Cup. And you know, so this isn't the Olympics. In a way, it's kind of the reverse of how things work in soccer, where the Olympics is kind of the under 23 tournament. And then the World Cup is the big international tournament. And for basketball, it's the opposite. Everybody cares about the Olympics. They care about winning Olympic gold. But apparently nobody wants to play in the FIBA World Cup. And part of it is, you know, because there's the worry of injuries like these. DeMarcus Cousins was going to be a big part of this Lakers season, and he got injured before the season even started without even playing a game. So now you've got a tournament that is happening kind of right before everybody's expected to get back for training camp. So there are a lot of players that worked out with Team USA, even played a couple scrimmages with Team USA. What's up?
Hot take time, putting you on the spot.
All right.
Is DeMarcus Cousins going to get a, let's say, big long-term contract for the rest of his career?
No.
Okay.
I mean, what? An what ACL would you, injury and an Achilles
what
injury.
What would you say the kind of contract he'd be getting? Do you see him getting 1 or 2 year deals for the rest of his career for as long as he plays?
Yeah, I think so. Probably at this kind of mid-level with the, you know, he signed for $3.5 million this time, you know, like maybe that'll inflate the next couple of years, but I don't think he'll be stuck taking minimum contracts, but I think he'll, you know, between two really bad injuries and just his reputation in general as a difficult player, which I think he's I thought those were kind of bullshit when he was playing with the Kings. But that's also because I feel like I understand the kind of player he is. He's the type of player that you might drive a coach crazy because he's going to argue about literally everything. You're going to ask him to do something, and then he's going to fight you on it every step of the way. He's going to yell at you, but eventually he's going to do what you tell him to do because you're the coach, and he will respect that with his eventual actions. He won't respect that with the way he fights you along the way, but eventually he will defer to your authority. And then if it doesn't work, he'll roast you for it. But, you know, the coaches, you know, he got a reputation as a coach killer, partly because I think for his first 7 years in the league, he had a different coach every single one of those years. Like so many coaches got fired for the Kings. I think
that's
a big
not
part of that was
he got the reputation, Dave Easy. He earned that reputation.
He partly earned that, but also a lot of those coaches were just shitty coaches. So like it's like some of it is they couldn't work with DeMarcus Cousins and some of it like they just flat out deserved to get fired because they weren't good coaches, period. And
when he was in New Orleans, there wasn't a lot of word of hearing him argue with Alvin Gentry when he was in New Orleans.
Right. And then same thing with the Warriors with Steve Kerr. Like he was kind of a model citizen.
Do you think maybe, like you said, right? These were mediocre to subpar coaches. Do you think it's maybe that thing where you can And I say you, and I'm saying you as if you were DeMarcus Cousins, you can smell weakness and you want somebody who has the fortitude to stand up to it. So you present it to show that they can't, because maybe that's the only way you know how to do that, as opposed to somebody who would go to the owners or the GM and be like, hey, I don't think this guy has what it really takes to be in that position. Whereas rather than just going and saying that, you show that.
The way you say that, it kind of sounds like he's putting this out as like a challenge. But I don't think he's like intentionally doing that. I think that's just how he is, that he's just a very combative person. So like, yeah, you do need a strong coach that is willing to put up with that level of combativeness. Like George Karl did not work because he was not willing to fight that fight with him, at least not to his face. Michael Malone did work because, you know, from the very beginning, those two fought each other every day. But Cousins respected the hell out of him because, you know, they always fought face to face. You know, like Malone kicked him out of practice a couple times. In fact, I think their very first meeting like was a contractual meeting, and Malone told him, "You're not a max player," and that pissed Cousins the hell off. And then when Malone got fired, like, you know, Cousins was more pissed off than anybody else, and you know he took that personally. He thought it was his fault, he thought it was his fault because he got meningitis before then, and then the Kings lost 10 games. Like, Malone should not have been fired, period. And that was one of the biggest mistakes in the organization, and one of the mistakes that has led to this perception of the Kings being a dysfunctional organization. you know, definitely all the other coaches, you know, could have been Cousins' fault. George Karl was definitely his fault. But George Karl was like, he's a traditional coach that like wants to be an authoritarian, and he's not going to put up with people questioning his authority, but he's also not going to fight back face to face. George Karl will fight back through the media, and that pissed off not only Cousins, but everybody else. So, so, you know, Michael Malone, Dave Yeager, those are the coaches that worked in Sacramento. And those are the coaches that basically just did not put up with his shit and told him that they were not putting up with his shit, and continually chose not to put up with his shit. So as long as you have a coach like that, and I'm sure he's also calmed down a bit with age. So I think he's a good signing for any team, and you're going to get him at a discount. He's not going to get those big contracts again because of all of that reputation that he's going to have a hard time shedding, plus these two really bad injuries. But he's still a really skilled player. Mm-hmm. He's a very passionate player. So, I mean, you will at least get that out of him.
All right. I always love when JVZ comes to like the defense of DeMarcus Cousins. It's so good. All right.
I'm glad he's not on my team anymore, so I don't have to defend him that hard. Like, it's refreshing to have a team go like 10 games without getting a technical foul. Like, that's really nice. But I will always have a place in my heart for him.
Let's talk about some player mental health. Liz, oh, Cambage, I want to say.
Liz Cambage, of the WNBA,
mm-hmm.
One of the best players, plays for the Las Vegas Aces now, all-star. She basically took a couple games off, and basically you could basically list those as, you know, DNP, mental health. Like, she took mental health days, basically. And then nobody really knew what was going on when she took those days off, but she wrote an article for the Players Tribune, basically detailing like all the struggles that she's been going with, just the constant struggle that she's had throughout her life, but also just the fact that she took those 2 days off, and then, you know, and just taking that time off helped her kind of gather things together. And since then, since she's come back, she's played better than ever. She wrote that just as an overall discussion of mental health, but also we talked about the NBA's mental health initiatives last week and how they're willing to mandate that teams have at least one or two mental health professionals on staff. So the NBA is willing to do that, but they won't do the same thing for the WNBA. And both of these leagues are basically owned by the same people, pretty much. So it's not like the WNBA is kind of behind the times. It's the same people making these decisions. And for some reason, they've chosen to do this for the NBA, but they won't do it for the WNBA. So there's this double standard there. You know, like we've talked about that, and then like a bunch of other double standards about, you know, teams skimping out on, you know, making WNBA players fly coach and them causing them to like miss games, get games canceled because of that. They basically put WNBA players through a much more grueling process where they kind of baby NBA players because they see NBA players as investments and, you know, so they go through all the trouble to protect their investment for NBA players, but for WNBA players, they don't seem to have that same level of valuation. So that sucks. I'm glad she pointed out that standard because I kind of would have assumed that they would have tried to treat this mental health initiative the same way across all players, but they obviously haven't. So that's one thing to keep an eye on. With not just the NBA and WNBA, but just with women's sports in general, because, you know, to move on to our, you know, one of our bigger stories, this equal pay fight with U.S. soccer is, Like it's still going. Like it doesn't matter that the women's team won the World Cup. You would think, you know, that would cause, you know, a big groundswell, and it kind of has, but the U.S. soccer has basically gone through the trouble of hiring lobbyists to try to convince, to try to put out misleading information and convince the, you know, lawmakers that, that the U.S. women's national team is actually paid more than the men's team.
So let's go through a few of these things that they are claiming, because I feel like some of these things could be broken down in a certain way, but I feel like the way it's going about it has some shadiness to it. So, a few of the things they talk about is the U.S. women's national team players do have a receive maternity leave, nanny subsidies, health benefits, retirement perks, injury protection that the U.S. men's national team do not receive. So those are things that are in here under this lobbyist thing that. They're having these people go around and talk about and push and say where
the first thing I think of when they trot out a bullet point like that is, why doesn't the men's team have that kind of stuff? Why don't they get paternity leave? Why don't they, you know, get childcare subsidies? Why don't they get health benefits, retirement perks, and injury protection? Like, why is there even a difference between mm-hmm. what they get? On top of that, like the people on the women's team, they get a base salary. I think part of that is because the players for the men's team, like they all have, you know, a second job with they all play for their club teams and they get bigger salaries from that. Whereas the women's team, like it's almost like their club teams are the afterthought and their play on the national team is what people mostly know them for. Whereas it's kind of flipped for the men's team. So maybe that's why there's a difference there. Maybe that's why they get a base salary for playing on the national team.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They play more games for the national team. I think the U.S. women's team has played 20 games this year, whereas the men's team played like 11. So U.S. soccer has tried to trot out like, oh, the women's team got paid this much. The men's team got paid this much. And what the men's team got paid is less. But there's also a different number of games that both teams had to play in order to earn that money. So it's, you know, they're basically like they're taking the facts. They're kind of presenting the facts. They're cherry picking the facts to put out what they want to put out. Mm-hmm. You could make the legal argument that they are correct. But it's one of those situations.
I definitely would love a third party to go in there and do the math. But there's also like a weird predication on what of these benefits do you take part in, right? Like, and are these benefits coming out of player salary? Is this just something that is part of that base package of playing for the women's national team, the U.S. women's national team? If we break it down dollar amount wise, then we can look at it and say, but like the fact that you went and hired lobbyists and did all this other kind of stuff means to me, because of the stigma of what a lobbyist is, means there is some kind of shade there. There is something you're maybe, I don't know, maybe you're like, I don't know. It just seems like they're trying to hide something. So I feel like just went for like a mathematical breakdown, I'd be more ready to believe than I am right now.
Like lobbyists are expensive. So me, like why go through the effort to hire lobbyists so that they can squirrel around and prove that you are or are just like influence lawmakers to convince them that you are technically right when you could just take that money and pay the people who are complaining about not getting paid enough. Like it sends the message that, you know, like you are willing to like when people like right now, the U.S. women's national team, they are the figureheads. They are the flagship of U.S. soccer. They are the most popular players. They are the ones that win tournaments. They are like, you should be crafting your brand around these people. And yet you are fighting them every step of the way when they say that they are not being treated fairly. And, you know, instead of just giving them a little bit more, you are instead taking that money and paying people to go around and shout about misleading facts to just try to convince everybody else that you are technically right. Technically right is the worst kind of right. It is the, like, you know, it is the kind of right that leaves everybody sour in the end. This is not like, this is not a good deal for anybody. Like this is going to go to a lawsuit. Like there's currently a lawsuit and that's going to continue. But at this point, like it's very clear that, that U.S. soccer isn't willing to play ball here. And so like, what kind of message does that send for future women athletes who might want to play soccer? Like that tells them that like they're going to get fought every step of the way when they, you know, when they try to fight for fairness. And, you know, that's to me, that's just a terrible message to send. Like you could be like we said in other stories, like you could be legally right about this, but trying to assert how right you are just makes you look like an asshole. And sometimes people don't want to deal with assholes. So in the end, they're just going to be hurting themselves in the long run.
I definitely think there is a mid ground that they can meet in, especially with the current popularity of the U.S. women's national team. But I think it's going to have to happen in the courts. So on to our next two stories. We're going to go through these a little bit quickly. So this one poses the question that does the MLB need a mercury rule? Now, for a quick explanation, a mercy rule. Does it need a mercy rule? Where a couple of weeks
five
ago,
yard penalty or, on Cass.
after the Yankees lost 19-5 on Thursday, their current manager, Aaron Boone, kind of put out there that the MLB should have a mercy rule. I don't know why I want to keep calling it the mercury rule.
It's an interesting question because baseball games, like we've talked in the past about how baseball games are kind of getting longer and longer. I think it's kind of been a recent phenomenon in the last couple of years that like once a game is kind of out of reach, they don't even bother to put regular pitchers in. They'll take a position player and put them out on the mound. And that's part of what's resulted in these enormously lopsided scores. Like I feel
they ended up putting in first baseman Mike Ford to play pitcher in that game.
Yeah. And I feel like growing up, you know, part of this is probably the baseballs are juiced and there's more home runs, et cetera, et cetera. But also like, I feel like I hardly ever saw scores that were in the double digits where like one team had like 10 runs or more when I was growing up. And, but now that's it, like, I almost feel like there's like one or two of those games every week now. And, you know, and it's something super lopsided, like, you know, like this Orioles game from a couple weeks ago where the Orioles lost 23-2. And it's like these games are over very, very quickly. And, they're so over that they've basically given up on, like, it's better to just put a position player out there than to risk one of your pitchers getting injured.
All right, guys. So I'm gonna ask you a question here, and I'm gonna use the other major sports in America as an example. We all are aware of the concept of garbage time. So at what point does garbage time get nixed in all of the other sports? People are saying this about baseball. Baseball, sure, it can go longer than other sports because it's 9 innings and there's no real set time. But in the case of, say, an NBA game to where one team is like 35 points ahead at the end of the third quarter, where do we apply the mercy rule here? Does that apply when coaches just feel like, okay, let's just put in the other guys that are on the back end of the roster and just let them out the fourth quarter? How do we equate those two with baseball? How do we equate those?
I think, like, this thing, like the article states here, the World Baseball Classic, they have it somewhere between the fifth and seventh inning, and I think that's where that threshold is at double digits, right? If you're up maybe 8-2, okay, I think you play it out. If you're up like by double, like 12-2, I think by the time you reach the fifth inning, you go up, umpires go up to the team and you're like, hey, you're down 10 runs. This is your chance. You call it, or we play out two more innings. If you're nowhere within five, by the seventh inning, then we're just going to call the game.
And how many managers will really say, yeah, let's call it, let's get out of here? How many of them will do that?
Well, no. That's why I say you give them an opportunity at the fifth inning. If they're down like 12-2, and you're like, hey, if you can get another five in the next two innings, we'll let you keep playing. But if you don't, game's over.
Like, nobody will officially surrender, but there are signs, like you pointed out, DJM, like in a game where the coach has basically signaled an effective surrender when they put the garbage players in. That's, you know, when they have garbage time. I think with basketball, I mean, I do think it's a very fair comparison to ask, like, okay, well, they have garbage time in basketball, why not have garbage time in baseball as well? And I think, like, to me, the only difference is the fact that basketball is timed, so you know how long, you know, how long the garbage time players are going to be in there. You know that, like, okay, you put the garbage players in for the fourth quarter, and there's only 12 more minutes of game time left, and usually they go by pretty quick, because teams are not trying so hard to win at that point. So things go by pretty quickly, you know, and nobody's focused on nitpicking ref decisions or anything like that. With baseball, it's almost like when you put the garbage players in, they score more. And when you score more in baseball, you prolong the game. So I feel like, you know, not having that time limit for the game can cause the game to go on for a really long time. If you have these big lopsided scores. So I could understand the all the Little League and college implementations of these rules, like, they are done for the specific purpose of limiting the amount of time. It's not done to prevent injuries or anything like that. It's done so that, you know, like for the NCAA baseball, like, they only do it for the final game of a series because they don't want the last game going super long and affecting travel plans, as the road team needs to get the hell out of there and go to their next series. And they use it for conference tournaments because a lot of times, like, those games are all being played in the same place. And so you've got one game after another game after another game. And then if one game goes too long, then it delays the next game. So they have the rule in there for that purpose. And so it's meant to prevent these games from going super long. I thought about this from like a fan perspective of like what happens if you attend a game and it gets mercy called at the fifth inning, then you only got to see five innings of play, but maybe you still got to see.
I mean, if another team is up 12-2, I think you got your money's worth in baseball.
Right. I mean, you still got to see a lot of runs.
You didn't get to see the quirkiness of seeing a position player throw from the mound. You didn't get to see that.
Nah, fuck that. Most people are like, especially if it's the home team losing, most people are gone anyway. These are baseball fans we're talking about. Like 10-2, they're out of there.
Like goofy stuff.
They do.
And that's true. Like, you have 162 games, so like a little bit of goofy stuff here and there is probably good to spice things up. So I honestly don't know where I stand on this. Like, I mean, I'm on the
if the team is down 10 runs, I'm leaving anyway. So,
or maybe because I want to see which position player they pull to go on the mound for the eighth or ninth inning. That's where I'm going.
Maybe I think they should say they should award the win at a certain point, but then like, okay, at that point, like they change up the rules a little bit. They change up the substitution rules. So like any garbage players that want some playing time, like you can sub them in. And then at that point, you like there's no worry that you put those players in and then they're going to lose the game because they've already called the quote unquote game. I still like the idea of garbage time. Like, I still want garbage time to exist so that players who don't normally play can get a chance to play. I also still like the idea of preserving the fact that they're playing at least nine innings for statistical reasons, or at least for statistical consistency, that like there's 162 games of nine innings every year. So everybody's playing on roughly the same level of games and innings and playing time for records and stuff. But I'm in the middle on this. That's why I asked the question instead of trying to tell everybody how I feel about this.
All right, so let's talk about this triathlon that happened in Tokyo that ended up seeing two of its contestants disqualified for holding hands.
Not just two random contestants, but the two people that finished first, or first and second. British triathletes Jess Learmonth and Georgia Taylor Brown were the first two. They basically crossed. They had the ticker tape across and they crossed at the same time. I guess probably because they're teammates or something, and they were celebrating. They had holding hand, like they were cheering. They were holding their hands up in the air, raising their hands and together as they crossed the finish line. Okay. That's against the rules because according to the rules, athletes who finished in a contrived tie situation where no effort to separate their finish times has been made will be disqualified. So they saw this as, or I guess the rule sees situations like this as collusion, even though, I mean, they could have, I don't know, looked at the cameras, or they could have decided that one of these people finished first and the other one finished second. But I guess the rule technically makes this.
I mean, if you have the rule on the book and then that rule sounds like very technically written, I kind of go with the rule a little bit. Like you have to kind of know the rules of your game and you have to kind of live by the rules of your game.
So I would agree if this is like the Olympics, which is the And DJM also agrees with you that the letter of the law is pretty clear cut here. You can't do this. But also, you know, so I would agree if this was like a super, like if this was like the Olympic triathlon or the, you know, like a super serious event. I guess this was a qualifier. So I guess maybe you apply the same level of seriousness. I don't know. To me, it doesn't seem that hard to separate the two.
I mean, maybe on the technical stance, like you could say like, oh, that person was in a lead, yada, yada. But I think for them living by the letter of their law, I think you kind of have to like, it sucks. It sucks hard, but I think I agree with DJM as what he said, like written letter of the law.
I just feel like the spirit of the law is to prevent collusion. And yeah, like, this wasn't really collusion. These were just two people celebrating.
Yeah, but I don't know. I get that, but I think if you take that stance on it, if somebody then does something shady, right? And it's always that, right? If somebody does something shadier later on, they then use this in some way of protection.
They say we were just celebrating, and
yeah. So I think you gotta live by your laws.
Yeah. So because of this, two other people qualified for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. This was kind of a worldwide event, but I think if you place in a certain level in this event, then you automatically get one of your country's spots for your Olympic triathlon team. Okay. And both Learmouth and Taylor Brown basically missed out on their spots, but also nobody else in the British Triathlon Federation qualified or got any automatic qualifiers. So it's not like they completely lost out. They basically missed out on the gold and silver medals in this particular small event. But they'll probably get picked anyways to be on the team since it's not like, you know, other people qualified automatically in their spot in their spot on the British team. Because they got disqualified, other people placed second and third, or the third place person got promoted to the gold medal, and then two other people got pushed up to second and third, and then those two people qualified. So in a way, some people benefited from this situation, and the two people that got knocked off the podium didn't really get hurt by it.
I most likely, like you said, the British team is going to still end up in this, so they'll still be good. And these two people showed that they are probably two of the best to be in that spot. So I don't see a problem with this. And like you said, it's probably in the end, everybody benefits just like us.
Yeah. I hope you all benefited from this episode of Sports Odds and Ends. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com if you want to read more about these stories. We'll have links in the show notes. We'll also have links to iTunes, Google Play, and other places where you can find podcasts. Thank you all for listening. Actually, if you want to hit us up on Twitter, I'm at JVZ. Kaz is at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.